present during the prior hearing. Mr. Gansner, you were too, right?
Yes, I was.
Plus, there may be some questions. The reason I ask you about that, there may be some questions that are directed, because these cases raise, at least superficially, similar issues. They involve the Fourth Amendment and the same statutory provisions. Mr. Gansner.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrams. As preceding counsel indicated, this is a hard day for all of us. In some sense, however, there is no better way of demonstrating, I think, a commitment to the rule of law as opposed to the rule of lawlessness than that we proceed with the arguments here today. And I appreciate the opportunity to appear before the court. The landscape in which this case originated was dramatically altered by this court's decision this past July in State versus Eason, adopting a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. When the state brought its appeal in this case from an order suppressing evidence seized under warrant in this case, evidence that supported the defendant's charging with possession of heroin and maintaining a drug house, the state argued, alternatively, that...
Mr. Gansner, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Your papers are covering the microphone, and that will interfere with our recording.
Thanks.
I apologize.
Thank you. When the state brought its appeal in this case from the order suppressing evidence, we presented two arguments: that the acknowledged defect in the warrant in this case was an irregularity for which suppression should not be ordered, and two, that a good faith exception should be applied and save the evidence in this case. Subsequent, of course, to proceedings in the circuit court and to the initial appeal to the Court of Appeals, whose certification to this court was accepted by this court adopted in Eason the good faith exception. That's why I say the legal landscape of this case has changed. But from the beginning of this case, the facts and circumstances of it have remained, the material facts and circumstances have remained undisputed. And that is this. The state never disputed in this case, conceded, that there was a violation of customary practice and a violation of the Fourth Amendment in the issuance of a warrant in this case without oath or affirmation. That requirement, that no warrant issue except upon oath or affirmation, like the requirement that no warrant shall issue except upon probable cause, is part of the textual requirements of both the Fourth Amendment and the Wisconsin constitutional counterpart to the Fourth Amendment. That did not happen in this case. An experienced police detective with years of experience as a drug investigator, after completing a thorough investigation and compiling evidence that unquestionably provided probable cause for the issuance of a warrant, and I emphasize that the existence of probable cause in this case has never been challenged by the defense and was acknowledged and accepted by the circuit court, prepared a thorough, detailed affidavit in support of a search warrant. Frankly, an affidavit that might well serve as a model. It was then reviewed.
I'm sorry, just for clarification, I thought part of the defense argument, one of their arguments, was if it is not based on sworn testimony, there is no probable cause. Am I missing that?
I understand that. What I am saying is that the facts that were related in the affidavit, if sworn, unquestionably presented probable cause. And in fact, Judge Flynn, an experienced circuit judge, reviewed the warrant application and concluded that it did state probable cause. That is, the facts alleged in the affidavit established probable cause to believe that evidence of a crime would be found at the premises identified. The problem, of course, was a simple and important one, and it was not noted until 3 days later when the police investigator who had sought the warrant and who then executed the warrant was preparing the return to the warrant listing the items seized and discovered that when the warrant application had gone before the judge, it had not been sworn. The investigator himself did not sign and swear to the contents, nor had Judge Flynn required him to do so. What the investigator then did was to prepare a new affidavit. This investigator made no attempt to cover up or ignore what happened, but in fact engaged in steps which then were designed to bring it to the attention of the court and to any subsequent defense counsel in the case. He drafted an affidavit, which was appropriately sworn, stating the inadvertent error in failing to sign and swear to the affidavit before presenting it to the judge. He detailed the steps that had been taken in drafting an affidavit, taking it before an assistant district attorney for review for its sufficiency, and then taking it before Judge Flynn. And the utter inadvertent oversight in failing to have it signed and sworn before taking it to the judge, and the inadvertence in leaving the court with a signed warrant without the affidavit ever having been sworn. There was no evidentiary hearing in the circuit court when the defendant, of course, based upon the disclosure of the defect by the prosecution, by the state in this case, there was no evidentiary hearing. Instead, the circuit court ruled in this case on the basis of what were accepted as, in essence, specifically stipulated, but without question, the undisputed and unquestioned facts, both as to what was alleged in the affidavit to begin with, the affidavit in support of the search warrant, and to the factual steps that had preceded the application for the warrant and the inadvertent oversight of the officer in failing to have it sworn. The circuit court ruled that it could not regard the failure of the circuit court to ensure the issuance of a warrant on oath or affirmation was a mere technical defect. The court also said, in response to the state's urging that the court save the evidence in this case under the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, that because no good faith doctrine had been yet adopted in Wisconsin, the court was not free to do so. But the court made clear that in its view, this was a case where consideration of a good faith exception would be properly made. That this was a case where an innocent, inadvertent mistake by an officer, no willful misconduct or recklessness, no effort to evade the requirements, intentional or reckless attempt to evade the requirements of the Fourth Amendment was made. And in fact, as is undisputed, the very officer who failed to sign and swear to the affidavit himself was the source of the discovery of the error and its disclosure to the court.
How do you go about signing and swearing to the truth of the affidavit? What is the process?
In a variety of ways. The statute, Your Honor, 968.23, which includes a illustrative but not mandatory form for search warrant applications, is an affidavit in which, at the conclusion of the affiant's statements, the form has a spot for signature of the affiant, and then says, subscribed and sworn to before me, and provides for the judge to administer an oath and sign it in the judge's presence. But in many counties, that is not, in fact, what happens.
Would it be fair to say that it is insufficient to simply sign it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what more is necessary besides signing it?
Right. An oath. Or an affirmation.
How could the author...
A promise that... A formal attestation that the affiant recognizes the importance of stating the truth and states that what has been provided is true.
Now, the officer could have done that before the assistant district attorney.
Absolutely.
Or before the judge.
Absolutely.
Or before some other judicial officer, I suppose. How could the officer possibly have thought that he had complied with that? I mean, it's one thing, I thought I signed something, but how can you go around saying, well, I not only thought I signed something, but I raised my hand? How could you possibly do that?
I don't know that the officer could have done so, Your Honor, only by virtue of oversight. The officer, was there an objective basis for the officer to say, well, surely I signed? No, that would have been a mistake. But what we had here was an officer, if I can put this gloss on it, who was apparently very much concerned about marshaling the facts necessary to show probable cause. We don't know what the time, the temporal circumstances were, and because there was no evidentiary inquiry, and I'm not going to suggest to the court that there was a haste to get this before the judge and exercise the warrant, because in fact the warrant was exercised 3 days later, and the amount of detail in this affidavit indicates great care and the absence.
It's not an affidavit, is it?
Excuse me?
It's not an affidavit.
Excuse me. The application. Not signed. The intended affidavit. So I cannot say, Justice Prosser, that there was an objective, touchable basis for this officer to have concluded in his own mind that there must have been compliance with this requirement. It was merely overlooked, as it was overlooked by Judge Flynn.
Was it overlooked? I noticed in the facts that presented in the brief, I think on page 4, that was presented to an assistant district attorney who then reviewed it also, but I'm not sure whether he needed or, yeah, that's fine, but then of course it wasn't affirmed, it was not sworn to at that point.
Right. There is no evidence in this case, Your Honor, and the absence of this information on the state of the record we have distinguishes this case from a number of other cases that have been dealt with in other jurisdictions where there was evidence, in fact, that an oath was administered, that an oath was taken, but the written recording of it simply was not done contemporaneous with the oath. In this case, there is no evidence that the oath was taken.
Mr. Gans,
we'd be arguing a very different case if that was the case.
Mr. Ganser, you argued in your briefs that this was a mere technical irregularity. Are you now conceding that this was a constitutional violation and the good faith exception should apply?
We argued both, Your Honor. Let me clarify that. Perhaps trying to parse words too cleverly by half. I apologize for that, but let me make it clear. We did not use the word that this was a mere technical irregularity. In fact, in our brief, we made clear that no such argument would be made by us, that it is a mere technical deficiency.
Not,
exactly. It is not a mere technicality not to comply with
the orders. Are you emphasizing mere or technicality?
We think it was a technical deficiency because in this sense, but that does not detract from the fact that we concede that the requirement of an oath or affirmation is one of the textual, facial requirements of the Fourth Amendment. But included in Article 1 such, and the Wisconsin Constitution as well, included
but
in those...
But
so is probable cause, a textual requirement, and the good faith defense, to the exception to the exclusionary rule, goes directly to noncompliance with that facial requirement of the Fourth Amendment.
It seems to me, now that you have the umbrella of good faith to argue, that maybe you can choke less on the argument of technicality. You seem to be saying that it's a technicality, and you've always said it's a technicality, but you never said it's a mere technicality. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me someone continuously asserting that it's a technicality, it's a technicality, it's a technicality, may not be saying it's a mere technicality, but might be saying it's an itty-bitty technicality, or it's an unimportant technicality. Are you abandoning the itty-bitty technicality argument now?
I plead innocent to the charge that I ever referred to this as an itty-bitty violation.
Okay. Is there a difference between technicality and technical deficiency, which is the words you changed to the answer?
That is, and I apologize if I attempted to draw too fine a distinction. I believe that the state has conceded all along in this case that there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, without question. We also said that it is not. You cannot dismiss, and I think those are the words that I used in my brief, that the state does not suggest that a failure to comply with the oath or affirmation requirement can be dismissed as the failure to comply with the mere technicality. But here is what we have argued. The statute 968.22, which in Easton this court recognized as a legislatively recognized exception to the exclusionary rule, is a statute whatever the legislature expressly meant, that says some violations, some technical deficiencies in a warrant do not affect the substantial rights of a defendant.
Mr. Gansner, I don't understand your reliance upon 968.22 to override a Fourth Amendment federal constitution. Well, that's what you're saying. You're saying that you're conceding it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But you're saying because of 968.22, and I recognize this isn't just the first of the two arguments.
Thank you.
How can the state legislature or this court rely upon a state statute to overturn what is concededly by the state constitutional violation?
Okay. For these reasons. This is not a case, Your Honor, where no oath or affirmation was ever provided. This is instead a case where when the officer discovered the failure to obtain what should have been done in the first instance, failure to swear to the oath before issuance of the warrant, the officer drafted a new affidavit in which he spelled out how the mistake was made and then specifically averred and swore that the information in the warrant in the warrant application when made was truthful. So this is a case where the requirement, in our view, an effort was made by the state, by the police, to remedy the defect after the fact. In our view, this is as a result, there are really two bases for arguing, in essence, that there should be no exclusion of the evidence that was seized here. Because, in fact, the oath or affirmation requirement was unquestionably provided after the fact, and there is no challenge whatsoever to the honesty of that oath or to any of the information that was stated in the application. thus the defendant's substantial rights to the issuance of a warrant based upon probable cause and the issuance of a warrant by a neutral and detached judicial officer and not by the police were honored, albeit after the fact. If that is not sufficient, our alternative argument is, as the court recognizes, that the evidence in this case should be spared from exclusion under the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, as this court has enunciated and described it in Leon, with the additional elements, the Leon plus elements, that this court required in the Leon decision this past July.
Well, so, in Eason, of course, we required an Eason type hearing.
Yes.
So would you, if you prevail on this argument, would you... we would then have to remand for that type of hearing, would we not?
Two responses. If this court has any doubt whether the Eason Leon Plus requirements have been met here, then yes, that would be the correct mandate in this case, to vacate the decision of the circuit court and remand for further proceedings consistent with Leon, excuse me, with the...
We didn't do that in Eason, did we? We just assumed that it was done properly.
Yes. In this court in Eason, the court found... that that those requirements had been complied with. What I am suggesting to this court...
They didn't even know they had to do it then.
Absolutely.
So we don't have a hearing if we can find that this was done.
This court was in, this case, of course, was in the pipeline when Eason was decided. What I am simply suggesting is that if this court has any doubt whether or not the requirements of good faith, the standards for good faith enunciated in Eason have been complied with, the appropriate remedy would be to send it back. The circuit court at the time it dealt with this, of course, obviously did not have the benefit of Eason, didn't have those standards, and dealt with it in a different fashion.
What's the purpose of the constitutional requirement that, just to get it, I'll read the Wisconsin, that the right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, etc. What is the purpose of the constitutional protection that no warrant shall issue but upon oath or affirmation?
Along with the requirements that no warrant issue except upon probable cause and that no warrant be issued except by a judicial officer, to ensure those procedural guarantees against government overreaching and arbitrary action by the government.
Okay, and that indeed is the reason for the Fourth Amendment, no doubt about
Absolutely.
It. But
the
let's, let me suggest that the purpose of the oath or affirmation requirement is to help deter false or frivolous charges by raising the level for swearing out a complaint against one's neighbor. This is, I'm reading from a law review article that describes what was the rationale of the founding for the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment. Filing a complaint should be an act of some moment. If a person is willing to assume the risk that attends the making of a sworn statement, that gives, now I'm adding myself, some indicia of reliability. If
Absolutely.
You're risking
sure.
taking an oath or affirmation.
And subjecting yourself to a possible perjury or false swearing charges.
And
right.
do you agree that that is the underlying purpose for the oath or affirmation requirement in both the Wisconsin and U.S. Constitution?
Yes. Yes. And in addition, Justice Bradley, in addition to the requirement, the service that the oath or affirmation requirement provides, that I think obtains to all judicial proceedings in which oath or sworn testimony is required, which is to safeguard against falsehoods and impress upon the person providing the information the importance of providing truthful information by at least implicitly threatening perjury.
And as you suggest, the overall rationale of the Fourth Amendment was to kind of protect from unbridled
Absolutely.
Executive authority.
Absolutely. As well, the oath of affirmation requirement, and I think Professor Wright, Charles Ellen Wright, in his definition of the purpose of the oath of affirmation requirement, the Fifth Circuit's decision in Richardson, talks about the oath of affirmation requirement also helps to ensure the integrity of the judicial process by its promotion of reliable and accurate testimony.
Now,
that's correct.
This may be a rhetorical question, but where in the text of the Fourth Amendment or the Wisconsin Constitution does it say no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation unless there's good faith compliance?
Nowhere. Nor is there any language in the United States Constitution or the Wisconsin Constitutional counterpart to provide that no warrant shall issue except upon probable cause unless there is a good faith reliance upon a warrant that was not supported by probable cause. That's, I think, a key aspect of the state's argument here. Justice Prosser, in his separate opinion in the Eason case, properly pointed out that a little more care by the police and prosecutor in court in Eason might have cured the problem and might have prevented the enormous expense of judicial energy that was expended in the Eason case.
That's true here, too.
That's true here as well. A good police officer who, for whatever reason, didn't do what he had surely done many times before, had he done that, or had the prosecutor said, wait a minute, let's swear to it here, or had, when the affidavit, when the application was put before Judge Flynn had done what the form of the application contemplated doing. It begins with the detective saying, having sworn to the following, and it ends with a line for the judge to indicate that it was sworn to before him. Had any of those things happened, we wouldn't be here.
Counsel,
but in the same way, if a court determines that probable cause for the existence of a warrant issues, but on a close question later, an appellate court disagrees, we know now that under both the United States Constitution and the jurisprudence of this state, a good faith argument can be made if objectively reasonable reliance upon the warrant can be demonstrated.
And counsel, let me just go back to the basics about good faith. Those cases arise from probable cause. Legal issue can be a close call. Reasonable judges can differ. We agree on that?
Yes.
Okay. This is not a good faith. This is not a probable cause case.
No, there's unquestioned
probable cause. Now, whose good faith do we look at in Leon? Accordingly, our good faith inquiry, I'm quoting from Leon, is confined to the objectively ascertainable question whether a reasonably well-trained officer would have known the search was illegal despite the magistrate's authorization. Do we look at the good faith of the magistrate in a good faith? No. Who are we looking at? The executing officer.
As much as the state would like to place total blame for this on someone else, no. The good faith test does not say you test the judge.
That's what I'm getting at. Okay. And who was the executing officer here?
Detective Derringer.
Same person who applied. So, when he went out to execute this 2 or 3 days later, did he have a copy of his unsigned purported affidavit?
I can only assume so because the warrant itself, this appears in the appendix to my brief, the warrant itself refers to the attached application for the warrant.
You fill in the appropriate word, that the warrant have attached thereto the application?
There's no requirement that it be done, and my understanding of experience, to my knowledge, there's no requirement that it be done, and it's my understanding that there are two forms of practice in Wisconsin. In some cases, it is attached to the warrant. In some cases, it is not. This warrant application and warrant was drafted in such a fashion to specifically say it's attached.
So it's, at least from the record, the reasonable inference is that the officer had both the warrant, that is the judge's authorization, and his original unsigned affidavit. So had he looked at these documents within the 2 or 3 days that he had them, and before he made the search, he would have seen it was unsigned.
Had he done that? Yes. Which is precisely what he did do when he saw it after, on the day it was executed.
And so he would have, as a reasonable officer trained in the law, known, had he looked at it, it was no good.
And we know that because that's precisely what he understood
exactly
when he saw it.
So since you have something in somebody's possession, which he could have read, maybe should have read, didn't read, can he get good faith that way?
I believe he can, and that's the precisely...
That's the precise legal issue in this case, if you apply good faith.
Absolutely. Okay.
And so you think that the officer who did it, who went to the court, and then was the same officer, because you could have had two different officers. So suppose it was a different officer. Is it the obligation of the officer to look at that affidavit? Suppose he had a different officer. The standard is that if he should have known as a reasonable person it was no good, that's the good faith. If he doesn't ever have the underlying document, how would he ever know? Unless Donald Duck was the authorizing judge.
If the underlying affidavit was not there, he could not know if it was a different officer than the officer who applied.
As I read the search warrant, of course, the judge is saying that there was an attached warrant affidavit. So Judge Flynn, in a warrant, and he didn't go out there with the original warrant. He obviously, the original warrant signed was, he went out there with a quote copy. So the judge, I assume, well, it was signed. And I okay it on this 28th day of June,
sure.
1999.
I believe that's the case, Sean. Of course, we didn't have an evidentiary hearing here in which those specific facts were put before the court. But I believe it is reasonable to expect that the officer did not go out with the original of the application, that remained in the court. But be that as
it
was,
he had a copy, which I assume was an exact copy. We're not saying that it was doctored, right?
Right. I think the question, what we come down to is, and this is, I think this is clearly what's before the court, under Leon and under East, is whether this court could conclude that the police officer relied, whether there was objective good faith reliance on a facially valid warrant. We tell police officers that it is their job to gather facts, to make a conclusion as to whether or not the facts they have constitute probable cause. To take it, we either expect them, based upon their years of experience, to make that determination of probable cause, or to seek a probable cause evaluation from a prosecuting attorney who has that experience, and that's precisely what Eason requires in its requirements in addition to Leon. But we also tell police officers that it is not their job to look past the face of a warrant that has been issued by a judge.
I don't think that's what Leon says. It says, accordingly, our good faith inquiry is confined to the objectively ascertainable question whether a reasonably well-trained officer would have known that the search was illegal despite despite the magistrate's authorization. In making this determination, all of the circumstances, including whether the warrant application had previously been rejected by a different magistrate, which the officer might or might not have known, may be considered. So the fact that the officer has a facially valid warrant, at least under this language in Leon, is not enough, because there is an obligation here. If you know other things, that goes to the good faith.
Could the officer have done so?
Yes.
Should the officer have done so? That's a legal determination that's going to that must be made. The point I would make here is simply this. If this court finds that an inadvertent error, the only way, in our view, that the court should find that the good faith defense is not available, the good faith exception is not available here, would be for this court to conclude that police officers must engage in zero error, zero tolerance.
Well, you'd have
in the application of search warrants.
Well, you'd have to conclude that it's the officer's responsibility to make sure there's a signature. And maybe then from that we'd have to conclude that the officer had to conclude that it was dated correctly.
That it was what?
Dated correctly.
Dated correctly.
How far would this take us?
Sure. I think it takes us as far as the specific, you know, Leon made clear, and I think this court as well and Eason made clear, that the determination of the application, appropriate application of good faith, will turn upon the facts of the particular case, despite the fact that the standard is an objective one. We're not looking at the subjective thinking of the officer, but what on those particular factors an objectively reasonable police officer would have done.
Would an objectively reasonable police officer realize that he didn't raise his hand or didn't take an oath or affirmation? You know, we've got two failures here, failure to sign and failure to take the oath or affirmation. Would an objectively reasonable police officer realize that he did not take an oath?
In all circumstances, I cannot say. No. No. What I can say is this, and this I think is what makes this case so difficult, arising from such a simple deficiency. If there can be no objectively reasonable behavior or conduct by a police officer in the presence of a simple inadvertent error, then
a technicality.
I'm going to call it an error.
Okay.
Let's call it what it is. A failure to comply with the textual requirement of the Fourth Amendment. If there can be no objectively appropriate behavior, if a police officer makes, without willfulness, without recklessness, without an intent to mislead the court, a simple error, then we will raise the bar on police performance to a level that I am not confident the Fourth Amendment requires.
Does that get us to the question, then, of whether or not failure to swear is a simple error? Is that the precise legal question?
I think it does go to that. And I look as well at what the United States Supreme Court said in Leon, were the circumstances where a good faith could not be relied upon to save evidence that otherwise should be suppressed. And the four types of situations that the court specified in Leon do not appear to me to come close to the innocent, inadvertent error that was created here. And this court knows what those four circumstances are, where the police officer misled the court by information presented in a warrant, where the issuing magistrate stopped being neutral and detached and became a partisan, where the warrant was based upon an affidavit that clearly did not state facts that could give rise to probable cause. Or fourth,
how would they know it just
failed to particularize the place to be searched, and in essence constituted a general warrant that has been prohibited since the late 18th century. And this, the simple inadvertent error here of failing to sign doesn't come close, in the state's view, to any of those four circumstances.
And simple inadvertent error of failing to swear.
Yes, that error.
How can the officer on Delia reasonably rely on a warrant unless attached thereto is an affidavit? Because unless there's attached thereto an affidavit, you don't know if it's deliberately or recklessly false. I'm reading right from Marlene. Don't know if it's bare bones so that you would reasonably know that it supports it. And then Leon goes on to say the officer cannot reasonably rely on a warrant so facially deficient. Now, this warrant is not deficient unless you have an affidavit attached thereto. So doesn't Leon, and I didn't go back and reread the facts in that, doesn't Leon in effect require the affidavit to be with him?
I don't think so.
Was it attached there to a Leon?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll check that out.
I will address that in a letter to the court.
Because courts look at the facts.
But if I can answer at least your question in at least one factual circumstance, how can a police officer acting appropriately know without the warrant being attached that the facts that were stated in it stated probable cause, if the police officer who's executing the warrant drafted the application?
Well, that's why you have the Leon exception for that, because that's a difficult legal issue.
It's done after the fact. That is what happened in this case. Detective Thuringer walked this warrant application, gave birth to it, and carried it all the way through. He applied for it. He took it to a DA, he took it to a judge, he executed it, he prepared the return to the warrant, he then noticed the absent oath or affirmation, he then prepared an affidavit and told the court and the defendant what it happened.
Thank you, Mr. Gadsden. Mr. Richards?
May it please the court, good morning. Sitting here this morning and listening to the arguments and questions from the court, I'm left wondering what it takes. There's three requirements that are set out in Wisconsin on a warrant, and the Fourth Amendment sits on top of those three legs. First is probable cause. The second is oath or affirmation. And the third is describing with particularity the place to be searched. And through the Fourth Amendment over the last 15 years in this state, the United States, those three legs, I think, have been chipped away, reconfigured, and changed. In Wisconsin, first we had Nicholson that talked about the technical irregularities. And the 968.22 arguments regarding, well, it wasn't particularly described or it was misdescribed, but we still knew what was supposed to be searched. This past summer in July, we have Eason good faith requirement, which has said that it's good faith plus. And the state wants court to say this is good faith plus. And what the state's asking for is a huge leap of faith forward, even in what Eason says. Because it's asking to say that we're going to excuse the sloppiness, the unprofessional conduct, and the not looking at the details by the law enforcement officer who executes the warrant. And what they're asking to do is by expanding that first prong of the attack on the Fourth Amendment to go forth and destroy the second part, the warrant, which to me is the most fundamental and most important. They're talking about saying, well, we don't know what happened here, but he swore to it after the fact. I submit to the court, I submit to the state, that before you get to an affidavit, before you get to a warrant, the fundamental requirement of the Fourth Amendment is that somebody or someone raises their hand and swears to it. And that did not happen.
Well, counsel, is there anything in these facts that indicate to you or would raise any suspicion whatsoever in your mind that Officer Thuringer was not in good faith?
I question...
I mean, after all, he discovered it within, 24 hours, and immediately brought it to the attention of the authorities rather than trying to cover it up.
He didn't discover it within 24 hours. He had the warrant signed by the judge on the 29th at 11:15 a.m., regular business hours, had the warrant, had to take the warrant, and I was an assistant district attorney of Racine County, made copies of it, so it could be presented to the person it was served upon, held it for 3 days,
whatever,
and then executes the warrant, provides a copy to the defendant, the defendant's residence, goes back, copies it again after it's been executed to file it to court, and that's when the discovery is.
So the question that I have is, do you have any reason, any articulable reason, to doubt the good faith of Officer Thuringer?
To me, it's not a good faith inquiry, because you have...
Maybe it's not to you, but it might be to me. So I'm asking you, do you have any reason whatsoever, articulable reason, to doubt the good faith of Thuringer?
I have...
Because to me, the undercurrent of Leon and the good faith exception is that regardless of what occurs, there is no deterrent. I mean, the whole purpose of the suppression rule is deterrence. And that is not an accomplished goal when you have good faith. So I'm asking you...
I have my past experiences, Justice, of police officers in Racine County, where much Fourth Amendment law has come from, lying on affidavits and having prevailed on two Frank's Man motions in that county. We didn't get that far in this. We did an investigation, but we didn't have a hearing on it. Those matters weren't fleshed out. I do note in the affidavit that the client will... is in the affidavit is a Wilson tie. There are many of those questions that are not answered, but to believe that an officer who the Fourth Amendment and suppression is seeking to deter can go through the process and not follow the three specific easy steps.
Counsel, do you think that we have anything in the record that would indicate that there were ulterior motives in not having the officer swear to this?
I know of none.
Pardon me?
I know of none.
And there are none in the record?
And there are none in this record.
Do you think that, I'm really asking this question in stages, in substituting a loaded word of good faith, of ulterior motive, do you think that that it's possible, or probable as you see fit, that he saw it ahead of time, that he hadn't sworn to it, but that just seemed simpler to just go ahead and do it, and if was a technical kind of thing, and that it wasn't that important, all the facts. He never changes any of the facts in the affidavit, right?
Correct.
He never changes a word. And then he went ahead and executed the warrant. You think that's possible or probable?
It's possible. I don't know about probable. Okay. I know that many times, and I think the jurisprudence bears it out, they get the warrant, it's signed, they go forth.
Okay.
In Nicholson, the Racine Police Department street crimes, same group of people thought that it was that location. They realized it wasn't, and they said, what the heck, we're going forth, we're not going to withdraw, we're not going to freeze the situation.
Right, so, and you agree that there was probable cause and there was the right address. The only violation here of the Fourth Amendment, which everybody agrees is a violation, was it wasn't sworn to, right?
Sworn to, correct.
Okay. Now, your client is Mr. Ty, right? He gets a copy. Did he get a copy of the warrant and the affidavit or just the warrant?
My understanding and the Racine Police Department standard practice is they only give the face sheet. They do not give the affidavit.
Okay.
So he didn't have the face sheet when he went out.
That's my understanding.
Well,
that's the practice.
That is the practice. I routinely then go down to the court file at the felony clerk where they file all the warrants are filed by date and address, and that's where I go and get a complete copy.
Okay, now did he have a complete copy in his possession?
My client?
Your answer to that is no, he did not. Did the officer have a complete copy? When he left the courthouse, started to make copies, if I understood it, does he have the warrant and the purported affidavit in his possession? Together?
Yes.
But he only makes a copy of the face warrant for your client, the defendant, the accused.
What I know of, there are at least three copies made.
There's three copies of what?
The warrant and the affidavit.
Okay, three copies are made. Tell me about them.
There's a warrant that the officer makes with the affidavit that they keep and is filed at the Racine Police Department. There is a warrant where the face sheet of the warrant is detached and given to the residents. And there is the original, which is then returned and signed.
Okay, so who keeps that original while
this? Once the officer returns it, signs it, it's filed with the felony court.
But who has it before the officer signs it? Who has that original?
The officer.
The officer takes the original with him.
Yes.
Has it in his possession because he signs the original.
Correct.
And the original has both the warrant, that is what the judge signed, and the sworn statement. So for the 3 days, this officer had both.
Yes.
Okay. That's that's the standard practice because he's got to sign it. All right.
That's correct.
And it makes reference to the warrant makes reference to the document, the affidavit. Okay. So do you agree, back to Justice Babbage's question, that there is nothing in this record to show an ulterior motive for not swearing, that is, not signing this affidavit under oath, and that there's nothing in the record that shows there was any ulterior motive in calling it to the attention before execution?
I agree that there is nothing in this record regarding those facts.
Do you want to question this officer on either one of those statements? Is that
I believe that at this point, going back and having a hearing on these matters would be truly fruitless.
Okay. So we have, if I understand your argument, we have what appears to be an error that occurred with no malice aforethought from this record. We agree on that?
on this record, correct.
That answer your question? Okay. All right. So we've got what is called a mistake, an honest mistake, or at least there's nothing in here to indicate anything else.
I would say a reckless mistake.
Okay. Well, maybe negligent. Will you go for negligent?
I think if you're going to miss
I think
if you're going to miss something that fundamental, it rises beyond negligence.
Okay, we'll put it different instead of in the terms of recklessness. That an reasonably objective officer should have the knowledge that it has to be sworn, and that you're not going to let an officer not know that and say that.
Correct.
All right. So this officer should have known. Now the question is what he did with it. All right, now, why, counsel? Why do you view the oath so important? I concede it's in the Constitution, but as the state says, and properly so, we have gone very far in getting rid of probable cause by, one, the definition of probable cause, and two, by the Leon good faith exception. So why do you think we ought to hold tight on signing an oath when we've given up maybe the major issue?
Hey, call me old-fashioned, but I think that we still follow the law. And it's in the Constitution of the United States and the state of Wisconsin, and it says no warrant should issue. Not no warrant should issue, and then we'll swear to it after execution. And if this body sees fit to change that, I think that's a huge change. And it does fundamentally affect the process.
Well, counsel, if I can get back to a little follow-up here. The underpinning of suppression is to deter illegal police conduct, right?
Yes.
Now, what deterrent effect would be accomplished here? What kind of illegal police conduct would be accomplished here by suppressing this evidence that was admittedly by you seized by an officer subjectively acting in good faith?
It would let an officer know that there are rules and they are to be followed. And the rule that says that the state can kick in your door in the early morning hours in the dark is preceded by the steps that need to be followed, and this officer, for whatever reason, did not follow those reasons.
Okay, but there's rules that says that the warrant must issue only upon probable cause, and yet the good faith goes right to that and allows evidence not to be suppressed, even though it was obtained without probable cause. So I'm trying to... In my own mind up here, I'm trying to distinguish between, well, what's different about that and what's different about signing it? Because we've already accepted the jurisprudence.
The difference is there is a reliance on the act of the magistrate. The warrant is prepared, the warrant is signed, and it is looked over, said to an officer, probable cause. The courts have said we're not going to second guess that first magistrate and the actions, and suppression would serve no purpose. In this case, it is the exact opposite. It is the officer's conduct or lack of conduct in the not raising the hand in one of two places and swearing to the details, presenting it to the judge, and signing it. The deterrent effect is exactly where it belongs on the officer. You have to do the following.
Well,
officer didn't.
Assuming that you accept the good faith arguments on suppression of probable cause, on warrants lacking probable cause, what I hear you saying is that if the officer signs it and complies with everything but doesn't state probable cause but is in good faith, what are the officers executing the warrant are in good faith, that can be that is not suppressed because of the good faith exception. But a warrant that contains good probable cause but doesn't contain a swearing is not. So you seem to be elevating the swearing. At least if we were to go the way you are urging us, we would be elevating the swearing to the document
over and above the Fourth Amendment's requirement of probable cause.
Well, I don't necessarily, but I'm not the one who gets to make the law. I don't agree with Eason and the premises of Eason.
Sure.
But I'm not here to change that. I think that you look at the fundamental beginnings of the warrant requirement, and it is there. And we haven't, to refer to this as a search warrant, I submit to this court, is a leap of faith, because a search warrant does not issue until swearing and probable cause. And there was no swearing in this document, for whatever reason.
So it's your position that this is not a facially valid warrant in the first place?
There
cannot be objectively reasonable reliance on it?
I don't believe it is. If this officer takes a document, presents it to a judge, which she has not signed, and that document contains those parts, if you were to take the time to look at it, it's never been signed or sworn to. And it's not another officer taking the warrant forth for execution. It is Investigator Theringer who prepares it, who brings it forth for signing, and then is in charge of its execution. And he is intimately aware of every single step.
Does it make any difference, then, in the instance where the obviously unsigned affidavit is not attached to the warrant, or where the failure of the oath occurs in an oral testimonial search warrant application?
I think there's a couple of questions there. I think that if the affidavit is not attached to the warrant and a different officer were to execute a signed face sheet ballot, I think that he would come under the ideas and the premise of Leon. I don't think it would be the same if Investigator Theringer had detached the affidavit early in the game and then brought it forth. I can't believe that he can then protect himself from his own negligence or recklessness.
You mean if he had recognized before executing the warrant that he failed to swear to and sign the affidavit and
I'm saying if his procedure, or he had followed the procedure of presenting the affidavit with the warrant face sheet to the judge signs it without ever having the affidavit sworn to, and then he just detaches it before he hands it or takes it out and executes it. I don't think that's any different than this case, because it's always Investigator Theringer.
He knew.
Right.
Or should have known. That's your position.
And I think this case, there has been talk in the earlier two cases regarding Richardson. In that case, there were factual differences than in this case. In Richardson, the affidavit was prepared by the officer never sworn to. It was presented to the Assistant United States Attorney, who then read it to the judge. And the judge did state to the Assistant United States Attorney,
something like, is everything in here true, or something like
Yeah, true and correct. And he said, yes, it is. So it might not have been the formal oath, but there was the statement regarding, yes, it's true and correct, and the affirmance of that.
By an officer of the court.
Correct. And who had went over it and reviewed it and discussed it with the affiant.
Well, what's attached to the warrant if it's done in open court and there's a testimony?
I didn't hear the first part of the question.
Suppose instead of an affidavit here, there was sworn oral testimony. What's attached to the warrant? Anything? Not the transcript.
Nothing would be done, but the transcript would then be typed up and would be filed with the affidavit in the...
Filed with the warrant.
With the face sheet, okay. The transcript that would be filed.
You think that an oath is just a formality? I mean, people stand up and raise their hand, and it doesn't mean anything, and why bother?
I don't believe that. I believe that the reason a witness has to either take an oath or affirm is to bring the importance of the moment home to that individual.
And perjury. Perjury.
Yes. It's an institutional protection.
Is it? A crime of this, sworn under oath. Of course, there are other issues. What happens if a court, in open court, should fail to give a witness the oath? A witness testifies. Do you strike that witness's testimony? Do we have any cases to look that up? I did not.
I did not find any cases, and that was one of the things we looked into. And it's it would almost be, I think at that point it would truly be when the matter was discovered. And then if it was discovered before the trial was concluded, hey, judge, we forgot to swear so-and-so, it could be handled by retaking testimony. If it's done after the fact, I think you get into a whole different type of analysis.
The judgment is entered.
Depending upon the importance of that witness, what they testified to, and things like that.
Could I ask you, how would you write the court's opinion acknowledging the existence of Eason unchallenged? But you win. How would you write that?
It is not reasonable for an officer to rely on a warrant that has not been sworn to. And the officer's good faith belief is not subjectively reasonable.
Or objectively reasonable.
Or objective.
But you'd have to have more facts. That covers more than your case. That will...
I don't see it that way. I really don't. I see it as looking at what Eason did and what Eason took from the record. I don't think a reasonable police officer of 30 years' experience can rely on an unsigned affidavit that he personally knows he has never sworn to.
That's what I'm talking about. You need those facts.
You don't have those facts, do you? I mean, he didn't personally know that he was executing an unsigned affidavit.
How could he not? He never swore to it personally.
He didn't realize that until 3 days after it was executed, I thought I heard you say.
I guess I don't see how someone could not know that they didn't swear to a document.
Your position basically is that this scenario is never objectively reasonable.
Correct. It is so, and I think it's borne out by, you look through 50 states, all the federal circuits, you find a case where this has happened before. It hasn't. And to believe that a police officer can get through and go through the whole process, and this isn't an unexperienced officer, and do it, it's way out there.
Because the factual inference from this scenario is that nobody read to the end of this affidavit, because if they had done so, they would have seen that it was unsigned.
I agree. When you look at the affidavit and it's laid out in the appendix, I think it's somewhat misleading, because you know that that's not how it was put together. It was stacked page to page, and when you get to the page 13 and 14, which are actually page 3 and 4 of the affidavit, you know that they were laid out on top of one another. And if you read through the affidavit that Mr. Theringer, Detective Theringer, prepared, you go through and you get probable cause basically after paragraph 6. And from paragraph 7 and on are what I would characterize to this court as the boilerplate that's contained in every affidavit that the Racine Police Department Street Crimes prepared, putting forth evidence that they wish to look into but have no personal knowledge that it's actually there at this location. And so the judge read those, the ones that established the probable cause for the searching of 1410, and went back and signed it. That's what I submit happened in this matter.
The signature page with the notary acknowledgement is and was, as we see here in the appendix, it was not on a separate page.
No, this is the accurate affidavit how it was when I received it from the court file after I was hired by Mr. Tai.
And the endorsement on the warrant is on the same page as the warrant itself, as it's shown on page 101. Is that right?
Right.
And of course, the affidavit was not on the back of that page. It was a separate page, I assume.
Correct. And that's basically the Leon, the Eason analysis. And I haven't spoke about the simple deficiency, the mere technicality. And I submit that 968.22, that statute, is not applicable here. And I've referred to it in my brief. It's the U.S. versus Dickerson analysis. And we're talking about a constitutional issue and a legislature passing a law and overruling that. And I don't believe that that is appropriate. I don't believe it can be done. Those are my arguments.
Thank you, counsel. I see no questions.
Thank you.
Could I ask you, Mr. Ganser, right off the bat?
Yes, sir.
Flip side of the argument that I asked your opposing counsel. I voted against, I was not with the majority in the Eason case. As far as I'm concerned, that is the law now. What troubles me is the third and fourth exceptions to the exception to the exclusionary rule that are laid out in Leon. The warrant is based on an affidavit so lacking in indicia of probable cause that reliance on it is entirely unreasonable. And then the fourth one, the warrant is so facially deficient that the officers could not reasonably believe it to be valid. Now, how would you write the opinion to destroy his position?
Okay. First of all, with respect to the two scenarios from Leon that you indicated that you were particularly concerned with. First of all, I would say that the affidavit in this case could be said to be so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render official belief in its existence, that is the existence of probable cause, entirely unreasonable, only if the court could conclude that an inadvertently unsigned affidavit fits that requirement, fits that circumstance. In fact, the information, and one of the points I wanted to make, and I want to address your question very directly, Justice Presser, Mr. Richards has suggested that the affidavit in this case was somehow unread boilerplate, that the judge would have tuned out and stopped reading after paragraph 7. I think that's, Mr. Richard is relying upon facts that aren't available to me because they're outside the record. In fact, if you look at the affidavit, it's at paragraph 17. And there's only 19 paragraphs in this, or there are 19 paragraphs. It's in paragraph 17 that the specific probable cause identifying the specific facts establishing this defendant's connection with the premises is alleged. That is based upon utility company records of who owns the premises or who's registered as being the occupant. Moreover, it's paragraph 18, excuse me, it's in paragraph 19 where the particular description of the property in great detail is presented. I think it's
Mr. Ganser, your paper is over the microphone that's recording this. It's all right. We just want to be able to play you back.
I appreciate it. I think it's an absolutely unfair characterization or inference to be drawn here that Judge Flynn somehow read through the first few paragraphs and decided what the heck and issued a warrant, when in fact the probable cause for this particular premises and for this defendant are contained in two of the last three paragraphs of the affidavit. So I think this affidavit had indicia, showed probable cause, very clear probable cause.
You rely, and I believe you, on the inadvertence
yes.
of this. But there's something objective, it seems to me. It's more than subjective. It is objective. And if we go along with you, and I'm still open-minded on this, if we go along with you, aren't we saying, in effect, that objectively, an affidavit that is not signed and sworn to somehow does not violate this third point about indicia of probable cause, that you can rely on an unsworn affidavit. Isn't that what we'd be saying?
I think the third scenario is one, I don't think there's any question, Justice Prosser, that that this third scenario is one that was directed at the quality of the information. That is to say, the facts demonstrating, if assumed to be true and if sworn, establish probable cause.
I think that's probably true, but the facts of that case were a little bit different. I think
they were sworn in Leon.
And the issue was probable cause.
And the issue there was probable cause. Yes, I agree.
But what is the rule that would come out of this case if you win about unsworn affidavits? That's what troubles me.
Okay.
I'm with the good faith. No, it's there. It's the law. I want to apply it. But, I mean, help me.
The rule would be this, that objective reliance upon a facially valid warrant, and I know that in saying that, I am assuming a point, because it is my argument, that the warrant in this case was facially valid, even though the affidavit was not sworn prior to the issuance of the warrant. But that a facially valid warrant can be relied upon by an officer, objective good faith reliance, if the officer's failure to note the absence of an oath or affirmation is the result of nothing but innocent inadvertence. Leon makes clear that the exclusionary rule, and in a whole series of cases, the United States Supreme Court has made clear that the exclusionary rule is designed to deter and protect against police misconduct. Or Leon said, or Peltier, one quoting the other, or at least neglect. There was an omission here, but it was an innocent act.
How is that not neglect?
Excuse me?
How is that not neglect?
It's not neglect in the sense that I believe Leon is aimed at objective reasonableness in this sense. And this is the point I was trying to stress before. Was there a failure to do what a police officer should hopefully always do? Yes. Was there a failure to exercise some care here? Yes, although we don't know exactly why. But the point I'm making is this, is that there can be objective unreasonableness, it seems to me, in this case, only if the court holds that an innocent error by a police officer is never, and I underscore, never tolerable.
Well, Mr.
Not
Kansas,
any innocent error. We're talking about this particular sort of an innocent error.
I understand that. I understand that. But I think the question is whether or not an innocent error that does not affect the substantial rights of the defendant to have a warrant issued only upon probable cause and only by a neutral and detached officer was
upon
in
oath.
This case violated.
That upon oath under the Constitution.
As well. In that respect, I would just add something that I hope to make a point for. Of the requirements of the Fourth Amendment, they are all contained within the text. Of course, the neutral and detached judicial officer is assumed in the requirement that it only be issued by a court, but that perhaps may be the most important one. But it's the oath or affirmation that is really an operational requirement designed to further and ensure that the other requirements are met.
Yeah.
That probable cause exists and that the judge functions as a neutral and detached officer. And those requirements, I think, were satisfied here.
It seems to me that your argument is basically this, that there can only be suppression based on a violation of the oath or affirmation requirement of the Fourth Amendment if there is subjective bad faith as opposed to a lack of objective good faith.
Well, or objective bad faith, where there is reason, where there was any evidence, Yes, there's a subjective-objective quandary here, yes. Where there's any reason to believe that there was misconduct by the officer or an effort to evade. And that would be objectively unreasonable conduct. That's why I think an inquiry into subjectivity is not immaterial to objectivity, because it would be objectively unreasonable for a police officer to intentionally seek to mislead a court. That's precisely what Franks and Vann are all about.
I think you summarized it by either intentional or reckless conduct.
Yes.
Would that do it?
Yes.
Not
it should be limited to intentional or reckless conduct, not to mere inadvertent error.
Not negligence.
Yes. The court's been exceptionally generous in the time it's given me. I appreciate that.
Well, it's an important case, and we appreciate both you, Mr. Gansner, and who's been often here before the court as an assistant attorney general, and you, Mr. Richards. Mr. Richards, was this your first argument? I had not remembered you, and we appreciate you coming, and you should go home very pleased with yourself, as should Mr. Gansner. So, Bill, and we understand the difficulty in focusing for all of us, and safe travels home. We are recessed until tomorrow morning at 9:45.